The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire. Joining me this week as our very special guest is Hannah Beautycant, Managing Director of Digital at Mail Metro Media. Hi Hannah, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Great to have you with us. And also joining me this week to discuss the news of the week is our very own John Still, who is Head of Content at ExchangeWire. How are you, John?
Yeah, very well. Thank you very much for having me back.
Always a pleasure, always a pleasure. We'll get straight into the discussion of the news of the week, starting with the Association of National Advertisers, or the ANA, has carried out its first probe into the transparency of the programmatic media supply chain. The report revealed that over a fifth, 21%, of ad impressions are gathered on made-for-advertising or MFA websites, and that 15% of ad spend is currently directed to them. The study has also found that the average campaign runs across 44,000 websites. The ANA estimates that diverting spend from MFA websites, combined with other efficiency measures, could save the open programmatic market around $20 billion. Furthermore, as MFA sites reportedly generate 26% more carbon emissions than standard websites, reducing spend on them will have a positive impact on the environment. The ANA also claims that its report has virtually eliminated the unknown delta of unattributable ad spend identified by the transparency reports from ISBA and PwC, although transparency remains an industry-wide issue. So a couple of really key issues highlighted by this report, of course, kind of the leading one is the amount of spend going towards made-for-advertising sites, and then also the wider efficiency issues kind of highlighted by the fact that, you know, an average campaign is running on 44,000 websites of any kind, which is really quite an astonishing number. But my first kind of question on this story, and I'll come to you on this one first, Hannah, is what do you make of these findings, and do you think that the industry should be worried by them?
Yeah, we should be worried about them. I mean, this isn't really new news. We've known about this for quite some time. It's sort of the programmatic landscape. It evolved rapidly and opened up, I guess, an efficiency of buying across a wide range of domains. Somewhat got out of control because you've now got domains or like publishers that aren't essentially publishers. They're creating content specifically for advertising and to increase RPMs. And it isn't about the customer experience or giving them valuable content or insights. It's just done to pick up ad spend through programmatic pipes. So yeah, the more of these sort of transparency reports that sort of bring this to life and really showcase where ad spend is going, one, it is great to shine a light on it. And two, it really helps us be more efficient in where we are placing advertising spend. And from a buyer's perspective, you want to know the domains that you're running across. You want to have to ensure they are verified and compliant and not sort of bot traffic or clickbait farms. You want them to be optimized for that customer experience. So the more transparency we have, the better we can be. But yeah, I mean, it is a problem.
And I mean, John, what do you make of this report? Do you agree with Hannah that we need, you know, more of these sorts of, you know, bits of research to highlight the issues? And, you know, do you think that the industry is kind of, you know, really paying attention and recognising that this is an issue?
I think it's like, it's important that reports like this are coming out, and as much holding a mirror to the industry as shining a light on it, I'd say. You know, I was listening to Tom Triscari talking on Wayne Blodwell's podcast this morning about, you know, this is cheap reach and vanity KPIs coming back to haunt us. This is, you know, the industry's defined itself by numbers and hasn't cared enough about where those numbers come from in the past. Lovely quote from Tom Triscari was that these vanity KPIs are setting you up for a market that will provide you with all the crap you need. And that's exactly what, you know, that's what this report has shown. Like, an average campaign running on 44,000 websites is insane. Like, we're massively confusing reach with impact still. So yeah, it is important to see this, but Hannah's right. It's not news per se. We all know this, but seeing the figures laid out so starkly should be yet another wake up call, I'd say.
And what does the impact of kind of, you know, of this amount of spend going towards, you know, lower, typically lower quality, you know, junk made for advertising websites that, you know, can feature, you know, really kind of salacious headlines or provocative, polarizing kind of viewpoints. the fact that, you know, a huge amount of spend is going towards them, and as far as we know, you know, there's not as much being done about it perhaps than should be to, you know, divert that spend away to quality publishers. What kind of impact do you think that has on the relationship between publishers and their advertising partners or their potential advertising partners? Do you think it kind of adds a block between the two where they could work more closely together? Hannah, what do you think?
I mean, I wouldn't say that this the findings here creates a block. Open Marketplace essentially created a block, a disparity between buyers and sellers. And specifically for like rich media content providers such as news publishers, we have such significant scale and huge reach every day. 10 million people come into our properties, and it's sort of a disregard of the value of that content by placing it where an eyeball may be in a third party cookie dependency. I think that will change actually as we see sort of the next year really evolve and bring buyers back closer to the publishers, the premium content providers, where eyeballs and engagement and awareness really is attributed. So that will be a significant change for us and bring, I guess, the sort of the ball back into the court. Sort of pun for Wimbledon, but it's I wouldn't say this necessarily sort of created a blocker. It just created like a function of buying that has scaled up dramatically, kind of got a bit out of hand, or definitely got dramatically out of hand, 44,000 long tail domains, and has changed the landscape somewhat. But I believe that's coming back.
And what do you think needs to happen to, you know, make sure that advertisers are kind of, you know, paying more attention to where their spend is going, especially with regards to made for advertising sites and taking action to move spend away? What kinds of, you know, standards or incentives need to be put in place to make sure that happens?
There's like, just be aware, run the reports, look at the domains, block them. I could actually do the whole hour on brand safety and sort of the, like, people, you know, buyers demonizing publisher content around COVID or Harry and Meghan. I mean, you can't block these things and have a disregard for eyeballs. This is content that consumers are seeking and engaging with heavily and following podcasts. Everything's evolving around this content. It's not evolving around Joe Bloggs' views on toilet seats that actually have been created as, like you said, salacious headlines to drive users in for a sort of a one-hit wonder and curated for the ad, an ad landscape, an ad, a dynamic ad map. So they need to be vigilant, run the reports, take the time, stringent vetting processes to ensure that the sites within the network of their buyers sort of meet their quality standards, that they have quality standards and they're sort of valued under their marketers that they're working on behalf of and for. Just use the tools that are available to them and then cut back on a block list and make sure you have your sort of your walled garden, your preferred walled garden, and your known and operated sites that you are happy to run your advertising across.
Sticking with that theme, John, to get your perspective on this, kind of looking at the news article that we gathered this story from, you know, there's a quote from Bedir Aydemir, who, you know, is from The Sun, who spoke at ATS a few weeks ago, saying that, you know, these sorts of sites actually may score quite well for, you know, brand safety and viewability, you know, kind of the standard metrics, when actually, you know, there's no guarantee that they've been shown to a real human viewer. So, you know, does that maybe speak to a lack of, or not a lack, but perhaps, you know, an insufficiency of traditional metrics or traditional standards? And do you think that they need to be refined? And to Hannah's point, you know, does not more work need to be done to, you know, ensure that spend isn't ending up on these sorts of salacious or lower quality websites?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's again, it's back to the industry addiction to vanity metrics and to, you know, to huge numbers as compared to quality. You know, it's dead on. These sites aren't going to hit your block list terms. They're going to, you know, be built to attract your adverts, so they're not going to flash any warnings and stuff, but that's down to attention to detail. They will not see one eyeball. And yeah, until the KPIs change, until the industry starts looking and really working out how to implement that quality in their advertising, we'll see more reports like this, and the and that it will continue. And like obviously in the report as well, we had the discussion about the environment, and you know, we are getting a handle on the impact that digital advertising has on the world in terms of the environment, and stuff like this it's not going to help, and it's making things a lot worse. So the industry, you know, it has wide-ranging implications. The fact that we need to wean ourselves off these metrics, this addiction to high statistics, and really look at the quality and economy of what we're doing.
Yeah, just touching on that piece about the environmental impact, Hannah, do you think that the kind of galvanized focus or renewed focus on sustainability and the environmental impact of advertising, do you think that will add a further incentive to get advertisers to move away from these sorts of websites?
I do. I don't think it's necessarily being picked up right now with that regard. I definitely think it will transform into that as sort of premium content owners will start to talk about that. We're pushing it ourselves. But then at the same time, we struggle with the synergy that's placed on sort of a carbon footprint of the Mail Online compared to train line, for example. I mean, it's very different. So it's an education that's going to need to arrive around sustainability and how that's really going to evolve to sort of attack the made for advertising websites that exist out there. So their carbon footprint is going to be quite good, and they'll be again optimized for exactly that. It doesn't necessarily mean that advertisers are going to be then incentivized to sort of block this long tail of domains.
Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see, I suppose, as with many of these issues, especially around the environmental play. But we'll leave the discussion of that story there, and we'll move on to the next one of the week, which is that European publisher RTL and demand-side platform The Trade Desk have partnered to provide what they call the first step towards integrated programmatic TV buying. The union will enable advertisers to purchase ad space on the publisher's video marketplace and broadcast through its international sales unit, RTL Ad Alliance. The tie-up will allow advertisers to buy inventory across more than 4 European markets for a single campaign, offering the potential for previously unachievable scale. According to sources from RTL Ad Alliance, the deal will bolster the publisher's ad-supported content, which traditionally relied on manual work by the firm's sales team. The Trade Desk CRO, Tim Sims, said the union would bring more opportunities to everyone in the ecosystem. So addressable TV has grown a lot recently. The market spend currently, according to Ampere analysis, is $56 billion globally, and that's expected to grow by over 50% to reach $87 billion by 2027. And it's estimated that a sixth of advertisers' video budgets is actually being spent with addressable TV service providers. So it's obviously a really growing space. What do you make of the space in terms of its potential? Do you think that this deal is, as Tim Sims says, you know, going to open up more opportunities in a more, you know, in a fertile space that is currently growing? Hannah, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. It's like the consistent evolution of digital buying. I mean, this is efficiency, it's scale, and it's targeting. And it's moving within an environment that's sort of, you know, old and traditional to now emerging and addressable. So yeah, I think it's opening up many more opportunities. It really also, for me, what stands out here is sort of the cross-channel campaign targeting that can now be enabled, especially across markets.
And John, what do you make of this? Do you agree with Hannah's sentiment, and also with what Sim said about, you know, this is a deal that's going to open up a lot more opportunities?
Yeah, it's like, you know, supply path optimization is a huge thing in the industry at the moment, and this is it very much in action. You know, it's cutting out the layers. It's really making the most. It's an economic approach, and yeah, I think it has a lot of potential to open up the industry. I spoke to Kieran in the office about it this morning, and he was talking about the potential to kick off the SPO wars. You know, it's a new battle place for us, and it's a new opportunity. So yeah, a very, very interesting deal. And yeah, opening up the ecosystem can't be a bad thing here.
Certainly. Yeah, certainly not. What are the kind of the challenges around addressable TV? A bit more reading I've done has said that, you know, there's kind of, despite the fact that more advertisers are experimenting with it, there is a kind of perception that it is a lot more expensive, and that's kind of holding people back. And another kind of misconception is to do with the reach afforded by addressable TV, with, you know, a lot of brands aren't really convinced of how much broader the reach will be compared to kind of traditional broadcast media. From your own experience, how kind of prevalent have you seen those perceptions, and what other, you know, hurdles have you come across that are maybe inhibiting, you know, the exploration of addressable TV?
I think, I mean, there's challenges around it, which for me sort of is all around how customers are aware of what's happening with their data on these platforms to be used for addressability. So I guess like really there's a job to be done for advertisers and service providers to really comply with the regulations to ensure protection of personal data and privacy rights are sort of enacted. And that's all around sort of the GDPR impact of addressable TV technologies. So I think that there's something to be said there, because actually even as a customer myself, as I go through, I get so many different prompts. I'm really not sure what I'm giving my data away for anymore. And actually there's a responsibility here, as I'm controlling the household when I click OK. And therefore I've got children and husband, parents. So, you know, you really want to have ensure that it sort of is regulated and it's compliant, and my personal data is being managed correctly and adequately. So I think there's something there that will potentially hold people back. Then you've got sort of the, like, it's really fragmented, as you mentioned earlier. There's multiple broadcasters, different networks, different operating systems. If you're buying it, again, it's still quite siloed in the approach. It's brilliant. You've got sort of the partnership now with RTL and the Trade Desk, but it's still only sort of for RTL and their platform. So, you know, we need to really think about how do we advance that at scale, not to the extent that you'd be running across all 44,000 television sites, but, you know, you've got, how do you moderate this and manage it? But at the moment, again, it is siloed. I think I probably haven't directly answered there, Grace, but that's just what my opinion on take on it for the challenges.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's just good to know where the kind of, you know, the hurdles are coming up, because obviously there's a lot more adoption, but still, you know, it's still, I'd imagine, a lot more scale. And as we've discussed previously on the podcast and elsewhere at our events and such, you know, there's still so much growth to be had there. That's obviously not there yet. So, you know, it's good to unpick the reasons why advertisers are still maybe hanging back. An interesting point, kind of just picking up on what you said there, Hannah, about, you know, the data play and kind of wariness from viewers as well to hand over their own data. What are the benefits in terms of the user experience from the user side of addressable TV? And do you think that they are, I suppose, displayed enough, or do you think that advertisers are aware enough of those benefits, and maybe if they were, they would invest more in it? What do you make of that?
I don't think the consumers are. I think we all sort of are seeking more targeted advertising across sort of the television channels of which we're engaging, whether it's cable, satellite, OTT, like across all of them. And actually you want that synergy to then take you from TV onto mobile through to maybe my podcast. Like, I want them all interconnected, and I think it can be more tangible, but at the moment we're not seeing that. I know the US have really scaled in this area, and it is sort of fundamentally powered by targeted addressable purchases. But yeah, for the UK, I haven't quite seen it come to fruition. So I think we're all really excited. I think there's a whole play for advertisers to really layer in on here. But again, I come all the way back to technical infrastructure, fragmented ecosystem, until they really sort of resolve and become sort of a standardized sort of plug and play environment, it will be, which of course this sort of announcement has started to make waves for. We need a few more of those, I think, for it to start to really scale.
Yeah, John, what do you think? What have you seen in terms of the bigger hurdles, and do you think that the kind of the consumer facing benefits of addressable TV are really kind of prevalent and showcased enough?
I think, as we heard at ATS and we've heard at conferences, not just this year but last year as well, like AdTech's gone big on CTV, on addressable TV. It's where it's putting the money going forward, as well as retail media, which we'll talk about next, I think. But it is, again, like for consumers, an education piece for sure. Like to Hannah's point about whose data am I giving away? It's not just mine, it's the whole household's. I think the opportunity is huge, and the changes to the ecosystem that we're potentially seeing with deals like this have long, far-reaching implications. But the risks, I suppose, and the challenges are not making the same mistakes again. Not really just repeating what we did with digital display and ending up down the line in a battle for privacy and having to convince consumers that we've lost the trust of entirely on their televisions as well as their laptop screens. So I think that's going to be one of the big hurdles, is just making sure that these environments in this new tech, in this burgeoning technology and infrastructure is compliant and useful and works for the consumer.
All right. Well, we'll move on to our final news story of the week, which, as John has mentioned, discusses retail media. And that is that retail media is expected to become the fastest growing ad format from 2024. With ad spend set to overtake linear TV from 2025, Insider Intelligence forecasts. At present, 40% of US retailers provide some inventory via their own retail media network, according to analysis from CitrusAd. Retail media networks Walmart and Instacart are expected to see the highest growth among digital ad businesses this year, per Insider. While the space may be dominated by a handful of large players, smaller firms may be able to rely on middlemen to get involved in retail media without having to launch their own network, says Insider analyst Max Willens. However, marketers should be wary that challenges persist, including attribution, a lack of standardization, and advertisers' opposition towards the walled garden model. So yeah, retail media, very, very hot, fast-growing space, so much discussion around its explosive growth and its further potential. How are we seeing industry players currently engage with retail media at present, and how do you think that will evolve going forward, Hannah?
I mean, everyone's jumping on retail media, aren't they? So I think, retailers are becoming advertisers. They have a deep understanding of their customer preferences and their shopping behaviours to really sort of make a play in this space, especially obviously off the back of cookie deprecation and having that first party identifier, taking it all the way through to checkout for qualified ROI. It's awesome. So then you've got brands as advertisers now coming on. I guess they're recognizing the potential of retail media and actively engaging with retailers to promote their products on the digital shelf. And taking that all the way through. Advertising agencies, media buying platforms, like forming partnerships now. You're starting to see sort of connections with preferred partners. I think you've got Nectar, DV360. You've obviously got Walmart that just established themselves. Amazon, the biggest player out there. I mean, what are we seeing is that there's players who really own this space as well, and really sort of showing, sort of shining a light on the ways of which you can operate within it. What you can see from this, if we go all the way back to the beginning, it's like the made for advertising sites, retailers in the space of retail media networks are not doing that. They're choosing their preferred partnerships, their preferred ad tech provider, they're creating, the transactional chain, they are owning it. And I think that really is sort of the biggest fundamental shift from my point of view that I see, with one, leveraging identity-led solutions, end-to-end targeting and qualification of ad spend. It's obviously an exciting topic for me. all the way through to, the preferred partnerships. You will not get 44,000 domains running a retail media network, she says, but I believe that won't be the case. You've got your preferred routes.
Definitely. And John, what about you? How have you seen players kind of get involved with retail media so far?
Yeah, it's exactly as Hannah said, like everyone wants a piece. Everyone's getting into retail media. It's the big thing that we're hearing a lot about this year. Kiese Lamore from Wunderman Thompson said at ATS London, she was giving some stats, global spend on retail media could be 122 billion this year, 3.3 billion in the UK alone. So it's big. It's a really big space. And it's fascinating because, again, as Hannah said, it's offering the alternative to your campaign ending up on 44,000 sites, most of which are junk. It is reaching the customers that are interested in your product at the point where they buy the product. It promises great return on spend and is incredibly attractive to advertisers and as well to the brands getting into it. So it's going to be, a fascinating area to see how it really develops going forward. But huge opportunity. And people really are starting to engage with it and look at it seriously.
Yeah, definitely. I remember Kiese saying as well something about the margins of retail media are, you know, massive opportunity there. But you know, considering the main advantages, there are of course challenges as well. It's still a relatively new space, still under development. What are the kind of the main challenges that are, you know, hampering growth to an extent, and how do you see those being overcome, Hannah?
I come back to data privacy and consent with the customer. Retailers really need to be transparent about their data collection and what they're using it for. And I think that's such a shift in actually what they've done to date, of having to sort of bring that on to sort of layer one, layer two of the CMP, to showcase like what they're going to be doing with that first-party data and all of the providers of which they're working with. It's really not the space they've been working in to date. So they've had to do sort of learning, be instrumental in ensuring that information is shared correctly with their consumers, updating privacy policies. And then, of course, ensuring that the partners that they're using to create sort of targetable identifiers, both on their properties and offsite, are, you know, again, understood by the consumer base. So they know who, what a DSP is, what a DMP is, what third party identity sort of, I suppose, interlinks are. So when you see LiveRamp on a privacy policy, do you know who they are? So it's just about that, making sure the explainer is there, because these are people who are shopping on their platforms. They understand the product and the concept. They don't understand ad tech and all of the nuances within it. So data privacy, consent, being transparent, ensuring, of course, that they've still got the same fundamental mechanisms that every digital media owner has out there, so that they are compliant with ad fraud and viewability. They understand elements of transparency. And that, of course, they have a good operation where they can run the attribution and the measurement to really qualify the ROI at the end point. Because again, this is very new to retailers that are sort of immersifying in this space and sort of digitalizing their shelf and then making that sort of addressable, targeted, essentially bespoke solutions for the consumer base. And then of course, taking that offsite and working with known operators to extend campaigns. So I think the challenges are that it's new, it's ever developing. You don't want to fall into the same entrapment that we've seen of digital, to John's point, of old. And we really want to sort of dramatize the opportunity and not sort of end up eroding it with our own, undoing it with our own work.
Definitely, yeah. And John, from, you know, what you've come across, as I mean, Hannah's given us a really good overview of, you know, some of the key challenges that are kind of maybe hampering or making brands and merchants a bit more wary perhaps about getting involved in retail media. What other challenges have you kind of come across within the space, and what do you think needs to be done to you know, overcome those challenges?
I suppose accessibility could be one, you know, how the understanding of how to get involved, that it is not just for the Walmarts and the Amazons of the world, the retail media play, that it is, you know, it's a space that can be opened up to anyone. There are companies that are doing great stuff in the space, in terms of the APIs that are out there that are available and can be used to build your own stack. But yeah, it's you know, it's a space that should be open, not dominated by three or four giants. And I think that's the next level of the understanding of it. Is opening up that accessibility and realizing that it is a wider opportunity than simply for the massive chains that are already in the space.
And thinking back to your point, Hannah, about, you know, data, and obviously, you know, data is integral to the offering. How can operators of retail media networks and the participants within them, how can they really kind of leverage the user data they have to really benefit, you know, their consumers? We are still, you know, in a cost of living crisis, inflation's still very high, and, you know, costs have gone up. What can the participants kind of, how can they really harness the power of a retail media network to offer value to their consumers?
Right product, right time, right person, all the way back to the beginning of the internet, I think my first ever job. So no, it really is, yeah, about sort of precision-made targeting that is personalized for the user and giving them product recommendations that are valuable to them.
Definitely. Super, super concise. That's it. And John, yeah, do you have anything to add to Hannah's kind of point there?
No, No, that I also had the old cliche in my head of right person, right time, but no, Hannah's covered that, so nothing to add, sorry.
No problem. Perfect. We'll finish the discussion of the news of the week there, and we move on to our second part of the podcast, where we talk more to you, Hannah, about your role and what you're up to at the minute, what you're most interested in. So just to start with, could you tell us a bit more about Mail Metro Media and, you know, what your role is within there?
Yes, Mail Metro Media is the domains for the Mail Online, which is Daily Mail Online. It's obviously global presence. I think it's the world's largest English-speaking newspaper online. Like I said, mentioned earlier, 10 million daily active uniques coming to our properties. It's also encompassing of the Metro, This Is Money, iNews, New Scientist, and other properties. So, yeah, it's a broad portfolio. My role is managing director for digital, essentially responsible for sort of commercializing all of our assets, so maximizing revenue opportunities, but sort of propelled by the customer experience. And first and foremost is sort of the UX and how we can sort of leverage that and drive the traffic and the engagement, and then obviously complement that with advertising solutions, because it's essentially an ad-funded business for the Mail Online.
Perfect. And what have been the kind of key areas of focus for you, this year? And, you know, we're over halfway now, we're into Q3. So what have been the kind of key focuses for the first half of the year? And what are you going to be looking ahead to as we progress into the second half?
First, I mean, it's interesting for me because my financial year runs October, September. So I'm coming to the end of cycle, and I've just now done the planning for our next fiscal. And in fact, our next sort of 5 years of planning, it's been really interesting time to lean in and really think about what we're sort of how we're starting diversifying. So we're starting to see new trends emerge with, consumption from our consumer media. So if you think of Notorious, it was traditional, it moved to online, it then optimized to mobile. And many individuals are talking about addressability on TV, connected TV, etc. But we're really leaning in on the opportunity to open up podcasts, short form video. And for me, like myself, I'm really sort of focused in on e-commerce growth. So for the next sort of year to three is going to be focused primarily on those areas.
Cool. And what have been for you personally, what have been your kind of your biggest interests within your role, and kind of thinking more broadly about the ad industry? What's kind of caught your attention most, and what are you kind of excited to see develop?
It's a broad question, Grace. So I love new media. I started, my first job was like sort of the dawn of the internet, it felt like. So I've really seen it change and diversify. And it, sort of my background was like hyperlinks on the internet through to mobile, where the launch of HTML5 and how incredible that was, the year of the mobile, straight into Samsung for connected TVs and over to Mail Online to sort of like propel their mobile offering, and then video, and then programmatic. So it really is about sort of the immersification of the internet for me. So I'm really interested now in short form video. I'm loving social media with regards to looking at like TikTok, Instagram Reels, YouTube Shorts, Threads as of like sort of late yesterday. So, I mean, it's changing, and we're all changing with it. We're growing with it. So it's just about ensuring that we're there where the eyeballs are. And we're ensuring that we're creating captivating content that is engaging for our consumers.
Thank you so much, Hannah, for joining us and discussing the news of the week and sharing more about Mail Metro Media and your work and interests. It's been a really, really great discussion. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And thank you, John, for discussing the news of the week with us as always. Great to have you.
Cheers, Grace. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. And thank you, everyone, so much for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.